I'm Tim Paul. Welcome to the Chips and Tips podcast. I'm Tim Paul from Toolpath, and this is Kevin Schneider. Kevin is a CAD CAM legend, godfather of Fusion, almost legit Tekken video gamer, overall badass. I consider him a friend. Kevin, I'm going to ask you for a second time because I forgot to hit record the first time, but please give a little intro of yourself, who you are, what you do, where you work.
Yep. Obviously named Kevin. I live in a place called White Salmon, Washington. It's in southern Washington on the Columbia River, just across from Hood River, if you know where that's at. I've been in the Pacific Northwest most of my life. Been here 5 years, sitting in my home office with my friend Tim. You missed fellow lime connoisseur, shops out there, right. Some Thanks toys I get that. To play with in my spare time. And yeah, been at Autodesk 26 plus years, part of the manufacturing group, joined when it was small, just 70 some odd people, joined when I couldn't even rent a car, had to be picked up, call people to get me so I could get to an office. Always been in the manufacturing group, worked on pretty much the whole portfolio of Autodesk's manufacturing solutions. And last 15 years of my life have been on Fusion.
Yeah, that's crazy. Autodesk has a lot of longtime people. It kept me longer than any other job has been able to keep me. But that's a long haul. So I chuckled a little inside when you said you couldn't rent a car when you started. I used to race mountain bikes all over the country. And I feel that pain because when you travel a lot, not being able to rent a car or by today's standard have Uber in your pocket, you probably had fax stuff back then.
No cell phone, as you said. So get on a payphone to call somebody at the office to come down and pick my ass up. So
What would you do? I'm stumbling. So I've done the job running around the country and the world helping people with Autodesk software. How did you deal with a computer back in 1960 or whenever you started?
Not that far back. But, how can we explain how bad this was? Laptops had bezels. And we're not just talking like, is it a 2 millimeter bezel or is it a 6 millimeter bezel? These bezels were measured in inches. Like the screen flipped up and there was 2 inches of compact beige around this 4-inch screen. And you were lucky to get that laptop.
What was the battery life on that?
Well, battery life, no. It was just
long enough to plug it in.
Long enough to set it down and open it up and remind yourself you had to plug it in. I mean, I worked with old timers who were there before me who were using VAX machines and mainframes. And they had to carry them around in a car and carry a monitor and look a bunch of the. Yeah. But those days are long past. I'm much happier with what we got now. So
that's great. Yeah. Okay, so White Salmon is pretty awesome. It's if I wanted to move north, that's on my list of places I would consider moving.
You've been here.
I've been here. Yeah. I had you introduce yourself when I wasn't recording, and I didn't notice how nicely framed that is, your shot. I didn't see the background. You have a very impressive shop, one that many... I'm not a jealous type of person, but me and many other people should be jealous with your layout and the size and quantity that you have with your office there.
Kind of you to say, nice.
Congrats on that. I know your last shop was a little smaller,
a little less than, yeah.
Well deserved. All right, let's do a quick lightning round. Okay, so we're going to start with first CAD tool you ever touched.
Yeah, KiCad.
That got me laughing the first time we recorded this or tried to record this. So I've pretty randomly heard of KiCad, so that's awesome. Yeah. First CAD tool you ever got paid to use
was Pro-E.
Pro-E.
Yeah, 90s Pro-E. You got paid big money. So it was the place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to write a note. I want to circle back to that because I'm going to try to keep this lightning-ish for the lightning round. How many different CAD tools have you used? We just counted this, but we didn't count when we
I said originally 12, but we now know it was 14. 14 of them.
That's
how many
a
of
lot.
How many have you used?
CAD, I would need to think four probably. Mostly solid. I mean, I was like very professional, proficient with SolidWorks before.
I don't need the background. I just need to know it's less.
Yeah. Well, how many? Okay. Since we're going there, how many CAM tools have you used, Kevin?
Well, probably four. Okay. Yeah.
I've been better than average professional at probably seven. So I went. So we're tied.
What was your first?
I always have to remember the name of it. It's called TechSoft. Which they have an interesting history, right? So TechSoft maybe turned into CamWorks. So I also used CamWorks. Might have been the only one I didn't really love. And then it was just like, I just wanted to use whatever got me to the next cool thing to learn, right? So maybe I'll write that down in my notes because that's another topic we could deep dive into later is like willingness to learn stuff, right?
Yeah.
I try to encourage people to be open-minded to learning new things.
You and I are pretty got some shared philosophy on this, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, lightning round. So how many different? Okay, so what are a couple Fusion features that you were most excited? Let's do two-phase question. Most excited to release, so stuff that had come in the past, that you were either like stoked after it was released or excited it was coming. And then I'll just ask the second one. Any fun things you can kind of share that are coming?
Yeah. All right. The first one, you got to kind of remember the history here long a ways back. Modeled threads, 3D printers about, 15 years ago started getting more and more prevalent, building prototypes, hand tapping stuff. But if you were getting to big stuff, you were forced to model threads with coils. So getting modeled threads in, we thought it was a nice little add, hadn't really been seen before by any other CAD tools. Sure made doing big threads and threaded holes easier. It's got its limitations. You got to know how to clock threads and add some offset if your printer has some extrusion challenges. But for the most part, that was pretty exciting to get something that was just flip, turn on a checkbox and go. Nothing had been that easy before. There's some stuff in the hybrid modeling that's pretty cool. If you're doing really fast concept work, not having to stumble around a bunch between lots of documents and you want to just get an idea out pretty quickly. That was exciting. And how all of that is real time. Those were some things that stand out as I think back. We've covered so much ground. Those maybe pick those two to start. Stuff going forward. Make a plug. If you're not a Fusion insider, you should go check it out. Join the program. It's open to anyone. If you're in it, you might see some changes coming to how parts and assemblies work that I think's going to be exciting. Combine that with constraints being added in the last update. And I think people's ability to take what they know from other tools and get into Fusion assembly design is going to be much easier than it has been. So I think that's something that's people should be on the lookout for. Yeah.
I like to go on tangents and I did call this the lightning round. So I'm trying to decide, do I just come back to my notes and see if I can make sense of them or move on? So let's move on. But real quickly say, I do want to talk about model threads later. I'll just say real quickly, I think they're great. I didn't realize the focus was 3D printing. I think they also come with some problems. So I think we should I'll put a star next to that one, so we should talk about that. And then, we'll just move on. We can talk for half an hour about that. So, so there's that. My favorite, because, you know, I didn't ask, but I'll just being able to move a joint origin or a joint. That was a thing you and I used to talk about when I first started using Fusion. I was definitely one of the early technical people at Autodesk on CAM. And I remember being like, this is kind of a blocker for me because I can't make my fixtures and you know, offset into JAWS and stuff. What I call magic chamfer, I refuse to call it 2D chamfer. But the magic chamfer tool that avoids, you know, hitting adjacent walls.
Yeah.
Steep and shallow was pretty magical. It kind of killed one of my most popular workshops that I used to teach, to teach people how to constrain tool paths from steep and shallow surfaces and slope and all that. People used to think I was a hero, and then I kind of died after the tool path came out.
Well, if people don't know the magic chamfer formula, they better go back and dig up that video. And
yeah, that's a good one. The good plug. That should be default, by the way. But all right, what's the coolest part? Coolest part, thing, assembly, whatever that you've designed and also made. It doesn't have to be the same thing.
Yeah, I'll pick two. So one, I worked for an aerospace company. They made their primary business was making bezels for aircraft. If you ever looked inside a cockpit, you'll see these bezels around all of the displays. They're really low tech. They're literally machined acrylic and then photo etched and painted, and they just glow because of lights behind them. But anyway, they had a side business, which was simulators. And so I worked in that group, and we spent a pretty long project building a full motion Apache helicopter simulator. And so we designed, none of the internals of that are actual avionics. So the hardware the pilot would see is all real, but everything behind that was driven by this company called Silicon Graphics, not around anymore. They drove all the displays and the simulator. And so, you know, being 20, sitting in the world's most expensive flight simulator arcade game with patchy helmets on and night vision goggles and sure the whole thing worked was that was a pretty fun and exciting project to work on. And then again, because when I was younger, I was living in Southern California and I was doing some RC car racing. I got some time to work for some manufacturers in the area, build some fun prototype cars and do some travel. So that was a highlight. Yeah.
Was Southern California can be the kind of the center of a lot of cool things like RC cars and stuff. Was it a pretty hop in place back then for RC stuff?
Yeah, it was. Probably to some degree it still is, although there's a lot more international manufacturers and global supply chains and shipping make it a lot easier to get stuff from different places. But
yeah.
You know, if you were in the mid 90s, you were in the States, you were probably running a Team Losi car, an associated car, and they were within 2 hours of each other in LA. And so you had all cottage industries around there, and great weather, great tracks. So
maybe we'll dive deeper.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll dive deeper into RC cars later because my current neck and back situation has made dirt biking less appealing and, or less of an option to be honest.
Yeah.
It's still very appealing.
It's good to have different hobbies.
Yeah. So I picked up my, I've had other RC cars, but I picked up a really cool crawler last night. With your experience in the simulator, do you think you could fly an Apache?
God, no. No way.
You don't think so?
No.
Really?
No.
Could you fly one in the simulator?
No.
I mean, landing is different. I didn't ask if you could land
it. No.
Okay.
I mean, hopefully there's some helicopter pilots up. Chime in on the comments here, but you know, the the combination of the foot pedals, throttle, stick control, and and just the like the muscle memory of how all that works together. Just not something, I picked up. Give me you know a couple months, a trainer. How many people learn to fly helicopters? Sure, but all I was doing in there was crashing.
There's some stat that Carol, my now fiance, if you didn't know, it's public now, I guess. she read some stat where it's something like and this is planes and helicopters are different, but she read some stat that something like 90% of men feel like if the pilot, you know, died in the airplane they were in, they could take over and get it on the ground. And it's like a disappointing percentage of women felt that women are probably a lot more realistic, right? But she asked me, and I was like, "Yeah, of course I can." And I would have said, "Yeah, I can get a helicopter in the air, and move around." I don't know if I could land it though. So I know helicopters are quite a coordination test, right? Okay, so the next light, we're going to try to keep this on the lightning round. So in your pretty close to 30 years, you said 26 years?
26 plus years, yeah.
Okay, so 26 plus. I'm going to say basically 30. And basically your 30 years of Autodesk, what's been your favorite position?
Yeah, being a product manager, it's, I think, best job at Autodesk, personally.
I've shared with you before. I had a product manager position on the manufacturing team.
I remember.
Definitely. I've looked to you for advice before, and maybe you let me down on this one. But it's maybe the only job I was like, I shouldn't have left that one. Mm-hmm. I feel like you're one of those people that like to let people learn their. A lot of their own lessons. I'm mostly kidding. What's the biggest mistake you've made at Autodesk?
Yeah. Generally, I like mistakes. I think if you're not making mistakes, you're not taking risks and learning. Something to be said for making the same mistake multiple times or making dumb mistakes. But let's put that aside. In general, mistakes I think are pretty good. I've made plenty. One I regret the most actually is not really like a decision, was not being careful about my words. I worked with a person, they are somebody I really respected. They helped me. We worked together great. And in the discussion we were having together, I can sometimes get impatient with the corporate world. And so I was a bit impatient and I was a little rough about a project and came to learn that that project was something this person really cared a lot about. That was a mistake. I should have been careful with my words.
Give me a rough idea of like where in your nearly 30 years was that?
About 10 years ago. Yeah.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I was telling Carol just the other night, I think Kevin is one of those people I've met that I feel like he's fairly careful with his words. I can be a little bit loose with my words.
Yeah.
So it was something that I've always looked up to you
with. Yeah, that was exactly this, you know, it was a meaningless comment. And it meant a lot to someone else. And that person was important to me. And that kind of really quickly made, it's like, I shouldn't do that again.
Good life lesson.
Yeah.
I don't want to beat up on corporate world, corporate life, but I've noticed my time at L3 before Autodesk and then again at Autodesk, that sometimes you have to be a little sensational to like get the big beast moving or change directions. And I almost feel like the corporate world turned me into like saying a little more maybe even exaggerated kind of stuff, right? Like I got into a habit of being like calling things terrible, and because the reality of life is usually a lot more nuanced.
Right? Yeah.
It's like,
this is a hot button, not a hot, but I don't know that it's even corporate world. I think culture in general, communication has gravitated towards extremes. You know, how often does someone say I'm cold? No, I'm freezing.
Yeah.
You know, even little things like that, it's crept in everywhere. So are you freezing or are you just slightly uncomfortably cold?
Yeah. Is this the worst thing ever? Or my near death recently has made me look at life a lot different. And that's some of the stuff I've been thinking about. Yeah. Biggest mistake. So I'm writing notes. I want to talk more about mistakes later. So I actually have a lot of stuff I want to talk about later. So that I put 3 stars next to, favorite tool in your shop.
Can I have 3? I've got 3.
Yeah, favorite tools. I'm sure I meant to say S on the end of that.
So one, and you're using it right now, like paper and pencil. Use it all the time. But that's kind of like, you know. My other two go hand in hand. Anytime something's not coming quite out, I use this tool anytime it's not going quite right, didn't end up the way I wanted it to, or a job is starting off really hard. And I'm sure we've all been someplace, we've made somewhere, doesn't look exactly like you need it. What fixes it? Angle grinder. If you got something, you get it apart, you can sit there, you got a wrench, you got a pipe, you're trying to get this thing. Yeah. You spend 2 hours because you're going to be smarter and stronger than that damn thing. Angle grinder, like 2 minutes later, you're moving on. So I love my angle grinder, and it gets me out of trouble when things didn't go quite right, and gets me out of trouble when it's not going the way I need it to.
Yeah,
which then takes me to tool number two, which is safety glasses.
Oh,
and if you know, you're a safety glass.
You're not a dum-dum. Yeah. I don't have a great sense of self-preservation. We've known each other long enough for you to understand that.
Yep.
Okay. I have one ear. I was born with one ear. I will take the time to roll up an earplug and stuff an earplug in, and then squint while I'm using that angle grinder.
Yeah.
And there's just no good excuse for it. I've had 2 or 3 times I've had shit dug out of my eyes.
I have aluminum in my right eye that came from a corn cob roughing mill on a Bridgeport, hollowing out pockets in an aluminum mold and not paying attention, and you know, wraps up a bird's nest and threw it straight in my face. In my eye, swollen for a week.
Yeah.
You know, and they were like, it's non-ferrous. It's not going to rust. We can't really take it out. It's not going to be a problem. It's not in your field of vision. So, safety glasses.
A farm boy and an angle grinder is a pretty lethal combination.
I can only imagine.
What's that? Yeah.
You can only imagine the trouble.
You can go a lot of directions with that. My uncle is just downriver from you. He's made a few amphibious Jeep type things, and he has one now that can drive through the Jeep, the Rubicon Jeep Trail, and go up river in the Columbia River, probably about 6 miles an hour. And I bet you 90% of that thing was fabricated with an angle grinder.
An angle grinder. So,
yeah. I would endorse that. Okay. If you were able to go back to 20-year-old Kevin, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
Oh, well, like Bitcoin. I mean, come on. Or like
Bitcoin.
Buy some NVIDIA stock. You know.
I love it.
Okay.
That's cheating kind of stuff. That's not life advice. I was looking for more philosophical life advice or something like that.
Spend more time making. And I spend a lot of time making, and it's still not enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was parts of my long points of my life where I let not having a shop or access to a shop get in the way of making stuff. And as soon as I got back to a place where I could, I was like, yeah, that was a mistake. At least for me. Yeah. So advice for myself, 20 years ago, don't stop making.
Yeah. I think the one reason we've always gotten along is we both have something in our soul about that. Mm-hmm. It's something I've always done since I was a little kid. And I said maybe before, I'm not a regretful person. I brought it up with a product manager role, but every once in a while I feel like I should have just stayed in the machining side of the actual making side of things. I don't really think about it much, but I have filled my garage full of a lot of tools to scratch that itch. So just yesterday, I made this little guy. Not super impressive. But it's cool. I mean, it actually could have been a very, very boring part. Yeah. It's a tool to adapt a Porsche alignment thing for a friend. I was like, I'll make it. I just want to make it more interesting. So,
because I can.
And I was testing toolpath, the automated toolpath stuff. And now, to be fair, Carol's actually making it because I can't load tools or anything yet in my machine. But I feel like I made it. And there was a second where I was like, this is what I was supposed to be doing. So it was a good feeling. So, all right, that's the lightning round, the not so fast lightning round. I have a bunch of notes to circle back to if we get boring and can't.
Sure.
Oh no, I've got one more. What's the appropriate number of limes for a beer, Kevin?
More than three, less than seven.
Savage. I wrote that down in my lightning round. I was like, oh, should I tell the story? I think we'll just leave it out there. Maybe I'll share with our editor a picture that I probably still have.
So. I think what we can say is that we have empirical evidence that supports my answer. Yeah.
I can definitely say I know what too much is.
Yes.
And we found that. I
think that was around seven. Yeah.
That was around seven. So I, just for the record, I was having beers with you in Portland. I'm a pretty light beery kind of guy. I don't like too much character in my beer. And Portland has a lot of character in much of their beers. So a few extra limes can timify a good mature man's beer. I'm having a Victoria because you make me nervous, Kevin, and I thought it would be good to have a beer on a Friday afternoon. So, all right. So I did some kind of pre-work, some notes. The next section I'm going to call like life and career story. This is the stuff that I actually, we have a buddy, Dylan Jackson, who looks, actually, for anybody that watches these, I have to pull up the picture. that might possibly be a fairly deeply related blood in your system. You know, that's your child right there, Kevin. So it blows my mind.
Yeah.
It blows my mind. And let's appreciate the old school picture I found.
That's a Kevin long time, man.
give me a rough year of that.
That is more than 20 years ago.
You're a handsome man. Oh, damn. Okay. Well, you've aged well. You've aged well.
Fine wine.
I did send this to Dylan Jackson. The reason I brought him up was he does the Within Tolerance podcast. He's great. I sent him a modern picture of Kevin Schneider and said, this is what your future looks like. Oh. And he said, like, holy shit.
I'll squirrel this one away for the future. Yeah.
Okay, so going into this section, the life and kind of career story. So Dylan does a really good job sharing a lot of industry people's life story, shared mine, and I can't get enough of it. I think a lot of people most everybody has a pretty interesting life story if you take the time to get to know it. And in our world here, I would love to share yours. So I was thinking through how to kind of break down your career from my perspective, and then you can correct it. But I stalked you on LinkedIn, and I was looking through that, which is a sliver of who we are, right? But I broke your life into a few categories, right? So like your hands-on maker years, mm-hmm. for me, that started when I was barely walking, right? Transitioning like tech sales, you know, tech side of the industry, that seems like a good one. Fusion leadership, I want to make sure we leave good time in, because a lot of our viewers are pretty passionate Fusion users. And then just let's talk about, you know, the bigger picture side of your career. So to me, that's when you became more of the director of big, cool stuff that was coming. Maybe talk about industry strategy. What's your current role at Autodesk right now?
Yep.
What's your current title and then role, whatever, well, however you want to present that.
It's a corporate title. I'm a senior director that has me currently working with our experienced design folks. So this is a change I actually was pretty excited to make about 6 months ago. It'll make a lot more sense when we kind of go through my career arc, but and I'm working with a bunch of folks who are kind of grappling with, as the product gets deeper and broader. We early on did a great job at hiding a bunch of seams in what in the past would have been different tools. We did a good job for a while. Now we've gone so much broader and deeper. Some of those seams are popping back up. Something I'm pretty passionate about. And so I asked for some time to go back and basically think of it as just make sure we don't lose that, that ease of use, that sense of craftsmanship around the product feeling like it's been polished by somebody who actually uses it every day to do things. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Cool. We'll dive deeper into that. But so UX is what I see on your on your LinkedIn for a lot of the machine people following this. UX stands for user experience. Is that
that's
right?
Okay. Right.
Sweet. All right. Well, let's start at the top. We could see how good our editor is. We could do like some Scooby Doo, like or whatever the noise is. But let's talk about your connection with making things, your early interest. I mean, you can go back to as far back as you want to go.
I bet we'll find we have some real parallels. So, I'll pull out a few things as I have gotten older. I reflected on like, how is it that I got where I was? So one thing that happened at parents who were in education, and it was an only child. And I think, that they were looking for ways to entertain the only child. If you've got siblings, you're outside throwing rocks at each other. You got an only child, the child's like, I want to do this and do that. So they needed some time alone. And for whatever reason, maybe it was that they were educators, I spent a lot of time with go draw something, go out in the shop and hammer nails. And that was pretty formative in like doing stuff with my hands and being creative and making stuff. And I talked to other people and like we compare backgrounds and try to get at like, why is it we have these worldviews we do? And that is, as I get older, as I said, this is something I reflect on. I think my parents did a great job inspiring me to have imagination and the confidence to do something about it. Like go.
It's awesome.
Think of something and then go make it. That followed up with getting Tamiya Frog, which got me into my first RC car.
What's a frog, Kevin? Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, that went well. And then wanted to go race it. Showed up at a racetrack. And run into some old timers who knew what the hell they were doing. Commercial welder, guy with a tool and die shop. Hanging out trackside starts great conversations. I was eager to learn, and that turned into, well, why don't you come over to my mold and die shop and start squaring blocks? I was 15.
That's awesome.
And so this is a Bridgeport. This is how you do it. And this is square blocks and start making blocks for inserts. And had some CAD, and that, you know, turned into my first CAD CAM experience. I would claim my first CAM tool, my first CAM software, was the offset command. Wasn't made by anybody other than my first CAM software. Draw this pocket, offset half the tool diameter, start picking up coordinate points, go to the DRO and start plugging in coordinates, and, you know, figure out arc programming. Mm-hmm. And that was where I started. Pretty young.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I started G-code programming before.
Yep.
Trying to think that through. I started G-code programming before I started using CAD, and I got pretty good at trig. And then discovered, like, oh, I can just draw stuff.
So I skipped
tangencies and offsets. And,
Had to do plenty hand coding, but again, I had the benefit of having at least some 2D CAD software and the offset command. And so that fast tracked picking up coordinates. So
never even thought about that. The mold shop. It seems like mold shops kind of specialized in types of things. What types of things did they make?
Again, Southern California, you're going to want to think about, like, where there's a bunch of manufacturers, spas. Mm-hmm. So, specialty at this place was PVC
hot tubs.
PVC fittings and hot tubs and polycarbonate displays for control panels, but mostly it was a whole lot of, PVC, connectors.
Okay. Cool.
So predominantly production mold shop, big, lots of presses, super hot, swamp coolers, you know, night shifts, stay out of the heat. And then quite a lot of it was short run. So it was a lot of aluminum tooling. And we did prototype tooling. And so I was in the prototype shop making inserts.
You did that through high school?
All the way through high school. Ended up running a Sync EDM machine, running some nice CNC equipment, hand polishing cavities. A lot of stones and WD-40, smelling like formaldehyde from the EDM machine.
Awesome.
It was fantastic.
Is the shop still around?
I believe it is. I've lost touch with the owner through the years. But I believe it is.
What'd you do after high school?
I messed around a lot. I transitioned out during high school. I spent at this place, and then I went to Cal Poly Pomona. So if you know Cal Poly schools, went to Pomona. Their end of the float's better than the Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. I'll just put that out there if anybody's a slow alumni. But
I've worked with both schools through my Autodesk jobs. They've got a Pomona's got a really good manufacturing.
That's why I went there. Program. I proclaimed to my parents at the age of 11 I was going to be an engineer, and I'd been around all this aerospace work and companies. High school, I was doing independent study for Lockheed's West Valley division. It's not around anymore. Doing CAD. I wasn't paid, so I can't say this was my paid first CAD, because I was doing independent study and I was working for Lockheed on Stinger missiles.
No way.
And so, I went to Cal Poly manufacturing engineering, mechanical engineering. Okay. And then I went to this aerospace company. So the RC car was the entry into machine shops and making things. And then that turned into knowing that was pretty much what I wanted to do. And then graduated high school and ended up at Cal Poly.
You got into the mold shop just from basically starting a relationship at the RC track kind of thing. Is that okay?
Yep. He was racing. His son was racing.
You piqued his interest and he talked you into checking out what he was doing.
Yeah.
How did you get, so we have a customer, one of my, I hate to call favorites, one of my favorite customers at Toolpath. He works at Accurate Sign and, Accurate Dial and Nameplate. And they do like the dial faces, you know, the screen printing and all that. Mm-hmm. Nameplates, you know, aviation's got nameplates on everything. And getting a tour through that place was, pretty neat. If you're into aviation, they had they did like the SR-70, all the, you know, it's like a history lesson and stuff. So it was cool. So did you guys, you moved into a place that made basically those gauges more
bezels,
than just
the bezels.
You made them. So a lot of your guys' parts might have been, you know, put together. How did you get into that job?
I was working in another machine shop. There's drama in this story. I was working in another machine shop.
That's some drama.
And I met a girl. And I was young and dumb. And I was spending a lot of time with
this. This is adding up.
And a lot of time with this woman. She was fantastic, a great woman. And the shop just said, you're just missing too much work. Your head's not in the game. And so I was let go. Only job I've ever been let go for. I spent the summer having a lot of fun. And then I was like, yeah, I really got to get my shit together. And, you know, we're kind of in this phase and something we'll touch on later, I'm sure. I really like to ask people questions, listen and learn, you know, so I'm constantly I give people any advice, it's learn to listen, ask people who know more than you. Most of the time you'll find they're happy to tell you and teach you and mentor. And so I was just speaking to some people in industry and listening to what they were telling me and places to go. And that turned into just a random conversation. Well, I know a guy and call him up. So called him up, asked him some questions about what he did, why it was interesting, if I could learn from them and do more. And he's like, well, why don't you come down and we'll put you to work as a contractor for a bit. And then, you know, within 2 weeks, I was doing production work and they were like, we'll just hire you. So
that's cool.
Yeah. That opportunity happened out of being dumb, but turned into an advantage. And that was my gateway into, Autodesk. So I can connect the dots there.
I think we're getting very close to that transition in the life chapters. Yeah. So I have some circle back to topics. So I have mistakes and learn to listen. I think learn to listen might tell part of the story about how we know each other, or how we became, friends. All right. So on the hands-on maker years, anything you want to wrap up with that before we move on to what might be a perfect transition into your...
Well, that was the period of my life I learned to wear safety glasses. So I'll just put a plug back in.
I've learned to wear safety glasses.
Yeah, safety glasses.
I've also learned to not stab my finger with an X-Acto knife. Doesn't mean I don't still do it.
We're not even counting scars here, are we?
Yeah, no. Okay, so how did that... So that's an interesting theme. I like to think about life as kind of themes, right? So you probably were learning some stuff and sharing stuff with RC car people. That built a relationship that got you an opportunity. You had a relationship with someone else that got you your foot in the door with this place. And maybe that's what led you to Autodesk?
So I was at the Bezel simulator place. Mm-hmm. That was Pro-E. That's what we were using in production there. This was mid-90s. And so there was this Boston company I'd heard about and this software called SolidWorks 95 Plus. And I was pretty enamored. I was like, yeah, this is so much better, so much more my speed. and we needed something in, the prototyping shop. And so we did an evaluation. I was the guy who wanted SolidWorks and the rest of the group, most of them had AutoCAD experience and they wanted, this software called Mechanical Desktop. And that was from Autodesk and they won. And so, we started getting training on Mechanical Desktop and, you know, if you can, learn that, you can learn just about anything. And having Pro-E experience, you know, they're all sort of at that point in time, pretty familiar. But the reseller, took a liking to me. I learned it pretty quick and, started helping, others, and we were banging out a bunch of 3D parts and assemblies and drawings doing well. The display company I worked for ended up getting sold, and the owner pulled me aside and said, "Hey, I kind of want you to know in a couple months I'm going to be selling the company. You should start looking for a place." I thought the reseller was an interesting opportunity, so I did post-sales consulting. I went to a CAD/CAM reseller in Fullerton, California. They're still around.
Can we share their name?
Actually, they're not still around. Okay. Funny story. Maybe another time. But I went to that reseller and started training people selling CAD/CAM software. And through that, I met the regional Autodesk sales rep, a guy by the name of Mike Bebout. And last I checked, Mike was at MasterCAM now, still in the industry. Mike ever seen this? Props to Mike for making the connection. He one day pulled me aside and said, "Hey, Autodesk is doing this thing. You might want to apply for it." And when I joined the reseller, I was pretty clear that I kind of wanted to get out of industry. I wanted to do the software thing for a bit. I was going to do it for 18, 24 months. And then I was likely going to go back to industry. And that was the magical bullet, because Autodesk at the time had a pretty strict policy that you couldn't hire from a reseller because they didn't want resellers training people and then poaching. And, you know, resellers were and are still pretty instrumental to customer relationship and industry competency. So you gotta maintain some boundaries there.
For sure.
But because I was already going to be on my way out, I got this tip from Mike and I interviewed and I got the job. And that job was to go build Inventor, which, you know, we can go down that path next. But
yeah. So to do what specifically for Inventor?
At the aerospace company, we had a group that was using ideas, and that group, because they were in defense, they were consulting on this thing called ASME Y14.41, which is now the PMI and MBD standard. I'm a bit of a GD&T nerd. And so when I got hired in, it was for drawings. Essentially to work on drawings for Inventor and make sure we had somebody who knew what they were doing with GD&T and to stay plugged in on what was going on with PMI.
Awesome. I still consider myself a GD&T nerd. This big poster on my wall there is the best poster that I've ever found. Dr. Hetfield. Anyways. Okay, so what state was Inventor at the time?
There was, I'll cherry pick what I think I can share. there had been a small group that had been working on it as a Skunk Works project. And the company had decided to move forward to go into full blown, fully funded. Yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to ship it.
Yeah.
And so they went on a hiring spree to bring in the remaining people that needed to kind of help get it from a set of ideas that showed promise into a real product with everything you needed for an R1 parametric mechanical CAD. So it was in a state of a bunch of demonstrable technology, but not in the form that it was shippable at that point.
Got it. I was a product of a hiring spree at Autodesk, ramping up for the manufacturing side of Autodesk with HSM and Fusion. So that's a fun parallel. Okay. So yeah, this is the biggest part of your career, right? So we're, share kind of how that was. Were you involved in sales? Were you, all that stuff?
It was a small group, as I said. It was about 70 people when I joined, so everyone wore a lot of hats. But the mission was really clear, and the people that had been hired in that hiring spree, there was an old CAD company called Intergraph. They had this 2D product called Imagineering and this 3D product that eventually was sold to Siemens. Most people know it today as Solid Edge. Was in Huntsville, and a bunch of people left Intergraph, and Northwest Oregon has a big company called Mentor Graphics. Mentor Graphics is now also part of Siemens PLM. They had been working on mechanical enclosure software. So that's formed the influx of people. So these were incredibly talented folks, like really building their second or third CAD tool. Get to work with a group like that in a small group with a shared mission. Things were exciting. 18 months later, we shipped Inventor R1. We were releasing versions every 3 to 12 months for quite a while after that.
Give me a year on that one.
September of 1999.
Damn. Okay.
Somewhere around there.
Okay.
I still have a VMware, not Parallels, but competitive Parallels. I still have a VMware image of Inventor R1. And every so often with some of the other old timers, I can pull it up and show Inventor R1 running.
It's fun. That's
needs
fun.
A Windows NT image. Yeah.
So now just making some parallels, trying to think through other people's lives through this, my life. So now I just decided, maybe the same month of that, I may have just decided I wanted to, become either a mechanical engineer or a machinist. So it's the end of the 1999 mountain bike race season. I was beating my body up and said, maybe I should go make things for a living. Yeah. So that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it was a blast. So I did that for quite a while. And as I said, I was learning a ton from the folks that I was working with. And then when you're starting a product, and look, the competitive selling between Inventor and SolidWorks at that point in time was just absolutely ruthless. I don't know that people actually even appreciate how ruthless the competitive selling was and the fighting for the CAD wars at that point. So you had to be out with customers constantly. And I happen to speak German. So I was spending a ton of my time up and down the West Coast with all these high-tech companies trying to help and learn, like, what do you need the software to do to buy it? And I was spending a ton of time in Germany. And so, and having a background in making things and making software, I think you and I both kind of share this affinity for just being in the room with people who like to make stuff and listen to them and talk to them. Yeah. But you also know enough that, you know, like a person can say, well, I'm doing this. And it's like, we've kind of probably messed around with that at some point in our lives. And you're like, well, tell me how you do this. And that person will go, ah, they have more than a passing understanding of engineering. They actually know a little bit about what we do here. Yeah. I can go a little bit deeper. The, you know, in the listening things, the listening category is asking questions and being able to pick up on things that apply to different industries and say, tell me more about that, can really get people to understand you'll appreciate the answer. Because a lot of times they might just want to like, oh, I don't want to get into the details of what I do. This person probably doesn't understand or appreciate it. Give them a little hint that, no, actually, I do appreciate it. Tell me more.
Yeah,
they'll open up. So I learned that skill with customers, and I was spending time with sales constantly. So I probably ended up 30% of my time, even though my job was building software, was out. Software.
Yeah. So have you ever at Autodesk had a sales role? A role that was tied to sales?
Well, let me answer the question differently. As a product manager at that time, a portion of your salary was comped based on the performance of the business. So while I wasn't a, you know, bag carrying sales guy, I had to make sure we closed deals. I didn't see
a dotted line or whatever. So that's interesting. The reason I asked that question is I've heard the old, you know, there's a lot of people that have a lot of affection for you at Autodesk, and a lot of them are old tech salespeople. Look at you as a legend kind of person. And the stories I hear are very much like, oh, he was tech sales. So that was my first job at Autodesk, was tech sales. And I made an ass of me and made, I assumed you had some time as a similar, you know, sounds like you did the work, right. But
I never formally was, but I did that job.
Yeah.
And I appreciate how hard that job is. You know, enough to the point that there was a time where I was like, all right, this inventor business is growing. It's building itself. It's into sustaining release over release engineering. I wanted to do something new. So I left building software, and I actually went to marketing. And at marketing, I ran the technical marketing. So tech sales were my customer, and essentially was in marketing and ran technical marketing for manufacturing worldwide for a good number of years. Yeah.
That'd be to do that well. Now, I wasn't around, so I don't know how well you did it, but to do that well, you've got to be a pretty good listener when tech sales is basically your customer, right?
It is. And you learn storytelling. Learn how to like, you things that I try and talk to people about who are in this space. You learn storytelling. You learn when to shut up. Like, what's the fewest possible words you need to say to make your point, and then stop talking.
Let's pause for just a second. That's a pretty good clip. That might be clippable. I wish that of myself more, to be honest. And I actually often share that as advice for younger people. That's a good
in the PowerPoint world.
Pause
like,
and reflect. Yeah,
people see the objective of get through the presentation. I got to get through all my slides. No, you want to say you want to pick your best facts. Say the least. Make your point well. Stop talking.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. How long did you do that? That's probably fairly fun position.
Maybe It taught me a lot about good bosses and bad bosses.
Your facial expression didn't support my my initial opinion.
The time with tech sales was quite enjoyable. I also learned a lot about good bosses and bad bosses during that time. Bosses I get along with and enjoy, and bosses I don't. Maybe they're good bosses for other people. Who am I to say? But
those are two good lessons.
Yeah, I did that for 4 or 5 years. Okay. And
then I went
back to product management, to building software.
How did you so you at the top of this hour, you have we have a wrap up. So I want to make sure we spend a good chunk of time on Fusion. So how did you kind of transition from that to Fusion? Talk about storytelling. One of my favorite presentations I've seen of you is kind of telling some of that history. I already said, but there's a lot of Fusion loyalists, loyalists on this call or that pay attention here. How much of that story can you share? How did that transition happen? How did the whole idea happen? And one thing, Inventor Fusion. I was doing some homework.
I'll tell you exactly how.
Do it. Now go.
Okay. At this point in time, I went back to product, and I went back to product because I was enticed by a proposition, an individual at Autodesk who was running manufacturing at the time. And his perspective was, hey, this inventor business is in sustaining release over release. It's been doing this, as I mentioned, it's one of the reasons why I left at that point, it had been going on for 5 or 6 years. And from his perspective, some risk taking had fallen out of the culture. And so he put together this plan to say, with a group of other leaders, to say, what we need to do is carve out a portion of our engineering that is incented to fail and do some more experimentation, take some risks. And they needed a product manager. And that sounded like exactly the type of thing that I like to do. And
I'm good at failing.
and good at.
And put me in.
And so this started a point in time where Autodesk had a labs program, and speculative software was made available through this labs program, and in order to gauge fit. And rather being academic, it was like, let's actually make software and put it in the hands of folks and get feedback quickly and iterate on it. And if it doesn't work, kill it and you move on. That
does sound fun.
That's where things started. And in that project, one thing, again, it's hard for maybe people to put themselves in the shoes of the past, but if you use SolidWorks today and you add a fillet and you say full fidelity fillet, you still get wireframe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back and look at old videos of most mechanical CAD, the idea of a preview of what you were going to get is pretty foreign. You filled the dialogue out, you clicked OK, you waited a few seconds, and you kind of got a result, and then you edited it. So my interest in...
Let me push pause real quick if I can. I wrote down his. So you said his idea. Are you... okay to share who he was?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's not a problem at
all. There's a lot of Autodesk fans on the call.
Our current CEO is Andrew. Andrew Anagnoff was the one who made the space. His I respect him tremendously in some of the perspective he brings about investing in R&D and trying things and managing risk. So yeah, it was Andrew.
Yeah. Okay.
He was running, common knowledge. He was running manufacturing at the time and common knowledge that we were doing lab stuff for him. So nothing secret there.
I knew the answer. I was just, thought it was worth calling out. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
I did. I just.
I'll try and be more brief. So, previews were pretty crappy and computers were getting faster and faster and faster. And NVIDIA was making graphics cards that were cheaper and cheaper. And so all of a sudden, at the time it was radical. It's like, what if it was just real time modeling? You just made the feature and you could drag it and it updated in size.
Give me a year when this whole thing started.
Oh God, you're stressing me out now.
Make it up. I found an interview. I can't remember the name. You looked a lot younger. It was 2010. You were talking about Inventor Fusion. Released like a plugin and something else.
It would be about 16 years ago. So we were working on all of this and had stuff kind of in the oven, and Space Claim came out. Space Claim was the first production modeler, which was all real time dragging, updating, modeling, direct modeling. And it got a lot of attention. I mean, the guys who built that have a strong pedigree in CAD/CAM, saw the same problems we did. They were first. They did an awesome job.
Do you know Brad Tallis?
I do. Yeah.
That's what he did before Autodesk, right?
Yeah.
Okay, just wanted to make sure I was thinking.
He was at Co-Create, wasn't he? He was doing direct modeling at HP Co-Create.
You're right. Act like I didn't bring it up. I love Brad, but shout out to Brad. Keep moving.
Yeah. So that became like a whole thing: direct modeling, real time modeling, it fits under that umbrella that I mentioned early on as a passion, which is, how do you make these things easier to use? Seeing what you're making while you're making it all interactive and faster, taking maybe some of the obstacles out of history modeling was an area that was worth experimenting. You saw now Siemens come out with synchronous modeling just a few years later. So there was a point where the industry in general was enamored with trying to move post-parametric. And it's difficult because parametric's pretty powerful. But that's how Inventor Fusion started. Started as a labs project under this effort that Andrew stood up to take risks and start making mistakes and start working on ease of use in order to make the products more accessible. And that was it.
I'll insert real quick. So you mentioned in the lightning round, briefly talked about just how you're excited to bring kind of the methodology of fusion modeling, which can be fairly unique and abstract for some people. Right. Mm-hmm. But I used SolidWorks a lot of years in 1999, actually, when we were talking about that earlier. And I was used to a pretty rigid way of, having to pre-think kind of some of my ideas. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things and it's fun to say now that I'm not an Autodesk employee, but it's, I can get crap out of my head, sometimes crap, sometimes gold, so quick. And I think so. It allows a lot of freedom. I think sometimes it actually adds almost like, if you're going to work on some big project, you got to like actually pause and
you have to reset. Really you can't use the same approach.
So it's an interesting thing because it's like a choose your own adventure. And if you're running quickly, you can run quickly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you're doing bigger projects, you have to kind of pause and rethink, okay, which direction do I want to take this? Doing a lot of stuff at home now. It's just fun to get something out of my head and move forward. So I didn't even make that too long.
Yeah, but, I think we did a pretty good job at doing that. Ironically, the more you know about, the more you know about these tools and how they work, maybe the more you appreciate, yet can constrain yourself to not be too crazy. I think the thing we've learned is it needs more structure. So we're gonna do that to keep people on. If you got an engineering manager over your shoulder and you got to get a product out the door and you probably aren't being given a lot of time to get trained, then some better guardrails are probably going to give you a better result. And that's been true for some time. It's just work. The team's been getting out the door.
Yeah. And that's a lot of the work you're working on right now. Yeah.
Yeah. From the standpoint of making sure it keeps this level of ease of use we're talking about. Folks really making those decisions is a group I work with. I'm happy that they listen to me.
Good. But. Good. That's one of the things I appreciated while I was at Autodesk. I have insecurities about my education pedigree, all this stuff. And I assumed going into Autodesk, man, this is intimidating. I'm just a dumb machinist. And the second week, I think it was the second week I was at Autodesk, I was having dinner with the CEO. And he was being a good listener, asking smart questions. At the time, it was Carl Bass. Yep. And it just made me feel appreciated, not to get all touchy-feely, but he appreciated the experience that I brought to Autodesk. And that was really fun for me. I think the Autodesk mostly, it's a big corporation, but it mostly does a pretty good job of appreciating people's, real experiences and stuff. So
it's fun. He's a great, great person. Has meant a lot and done a lot for me in my career. I owe a lot to Carl, definitely.
Yeah. He's a easy to love person. Yeah. It's a really interesting contrast between him and Andrew. And I've got to know Andrew, fairly well, but I definitely appreciate him. But it was being a manufacturing guy at Autodesk was more funner in the first few years of my career, because Carl's got a shop, he's got a shop with cool shit in it. He likes to make cool stuff. Andrew just asked smart business questions, and I've spent some somewhat personal time with Andrew, and he's pretty lovable too. But
he's a literal rocket scientist, and he's got CAD/CAM experience himself. It's just you get people's interests are in different places, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. So. Okay, so journey through Fusion. When did Fusion go from Inventor Fusion? That was a plugin. It was it felt like an exploratory kind of thing.
Yeah, we were doing that for a couple of years, maybe 18 to 24 months. It went longer publicly, where behind the scenes, there was some a pretty clear direction within the company. Again, you still have Carl as a CEO, but you have Andrew running product or various different aspects of product development, as well as a gentleman by the name of Amar Hanspal, who was also heavily influential in those days in product development directions. Okay. And the product leader, CTO of the company, and Carl and others internally were watching the trajectory for business applications in the cloud. And so going back more, 15 years ago, there was an internal realization that this was transformative for the industry. And so there were other background projects in play and technology constraints and decisions in play, but effectively there was a need to say, we're going to go cloud first in mechanical design. How do we get there? And how do we make that easy to use? And how do we bridge multiple disciplines together, manufacturing, rendering, modeling, simulation? You know, at that point, all the CAD-CAM vendors had VPs of these various different domains and had products that you could buy that were standalone for all those applications. And all of the vendors at that point had some bundle, SolidWorks Professional, you could call it, or in Inventor Collection, or you know, there was a name for the bundle. Yeah. But I think, you know, if we were to trace back and not give away too much, because you can see the trajectory, was a decision needs to be easy to use. It needs to be a convergence of multiple disciplines. All things we've said publicly needs to be in the cloud. And so we, hence the Fusion you know today was born.
So multiple disciplines, that's actually what I actually care about. So I became an HSM Works user using another integrated, you know, product. Yep. I thought the problem with that product was the fact that it was integrated. So I was like, nope, never again. And then I found HSM Works and was like, wow, this is how I want to work. Mm-hmm. And then through relationships I had with Al Whatmo, the CEO of Toolpath now, he convinced me to stop machining stuff and come play a software guy.
Yeah.
But I felt like there was this magical thing when you created multiple disciplines in one place, right?
Yeah.
There's two questions that kind of pop up for me is like, how were those conversations? If there's anything maybe interesting to share. I mean, it seems pretty obvious, like, you know, it should be in one toolbox. But the other one that I used to deal with as a application engineer selling Inventor HSM and HSM Works, I used to get asked all the time, like, Fusion's way less expensive. Like, what's Autodesk up to? Basically competing with yourself. What was it? Like, you said you saw a need coming, like you could, like, why didn't just switch Inventor over, you know? Is that enough for you to run with?
Yeah. And some of those things I can, you know, I can answer, and some I can't, just because of, you know, I still work there and I want to still work there and all of that. It's not that it's secret. It's just, and in some ways I don't know that it really matters. But I can kind of pull out the pieces that make sense for my journey.
So there's two basic questions. Like, what was the conversations around, like, bringing in CAM originally to Autodesk, right?
Well,
and then kind of competing with itself.
You kind of look at people who do these jobs as their livelihood, and you talk to them about what makes it fun and what makes it miserable. And it doesn't take maybe it takes a literal rocket scientist, but bad expression. You know, it doesn't, it pretty quickly becomes obvious at that point in time that it should be better, you know? And if you do it yourself and you experience it yourself, you very quickly realize, yeah, this could be better. And if we made it better, it's better for the people doing it, and maybe they'll want to buy it. And that's your angle. So there's no secret sauce here. It was, and you can kind of look at major industries and say, yeah, generally people need to design parts and assemblies and make drawings. A certain portion of those people need to make sure it doesn't kill you when you use it in a critical situation. So simulation is important. Yeah. The box has got to look pretty good. So someone needs to render it, and you got to be able to build it, manufacture it. And the handoff between any one of those disciplines is really cumbersome. particularly from different vendors that may or may not be able to read each other's files very well. And it's pretty lossy what comes across. And like, I mean, there's no secret that didn't work great.
It's easy to sell the main. Yeah.
Fairly obvious. Like if you can make that better, you know, what I can say is I was part of a small group of people who was there at the first day to say this problem's worth solving. And I probably had a hand in making sure that that problem worth solving stayed important. But solving the problem for CAM, you know, that's a lot of the people you know from HSM Works, like, solve that problem. The former Dell CAM team solved that problem. So they did all the hard work. Rendering team, the modeling team. It took a lot of people to do the job well in order to convince people to use it. But creating the opportunity to do that in one place and at least early on, making sure that that opportunity continued to be seen as important and meaningful is probably where I could place some of my influence in Fusion. Cool.
So that small, I've heard a few different perspectives of that small group of people having a meeting about this is worth investing into. And that's why I try to spread the Godfather Geek of Fusion title for you. And then how was the conversation of, because I just used to get asked all the time, like, Fusion's competing with Inventor. Like, how does that make sense? And I used to have my way of kind of talking through it. You know, Inventor competed with AutoCAD and so on and so on. But
we can start with some like not particularly controversial or interesting answers, but every other CAD/CAM vendor has multiple design tools. It's actually not that unique. If people kind of want to make a Inventor versus SolidWorks thing out of it, they're going to. I'm not going to change that. The simple truth of the matter was at the point in time to build a cloud CAD portfolio, the folks who knew the most about how to get there said starting with this particular code base over that is the way to get there. And people from the outside will see that as an Inventor versus SolidWorks and why one other than the other. And it really just came down to the constraints at the time on getting to the end game fastest.
Yeah. So looking at the clock, we have, let's say 20 minutes left. More of the big picture. You stepped into kind of the next chapter of at least when I'm making the chapters for your career in life. It was more of like the big picture, which is kind of what you're doing now, right? So more of a senior leadership of the Fusion team, move into UX. Did you start off on the Fusion team just kind of as a pretty senior person? And then how has that journey kind of, because you've moved around a bit since
I've been. I like it. I mean, how you stay at a company for 27 years is be willing to do new things. So that's just something that I take advantage of and try and make myself valuable in these various different places. And that oftentimes serendipitously turns into another opportunity. And as long as I'm helping the team, I'll keep doing it. I was in product management and running product management. And then there were people who were going to be better at that than me coming up. So I said, you should do it rather than me. And that was pretty simple. I'll go tackle this other part of the problem. So I have spent a lot of time with really smart, talented software engineers. I'm not a software engineer by training. But I have a decent understanding. I've spent a fair amount of my time kind of not at Autodesk, but in my spare time, really getting into systems engineering, understanding complex systems, how you take them apart, how you explain them to people, how you build them, properties of complex systems that you don't expect. And so I like the discipline of systems. And from that, you can kind of look at Fusion as a very complex system built by a lot of people, not all of whom understand how the whole system functions. And in complex systems, behaviors come out of it, emergent properties that you didn't intend. They're just a side effect of a very complex system functioning. And yeah, there are tactics that you can employ to try and wrangle, understand, and address these complex systems. And so I would say my career choices, my interest in general as a person who's continuing to make software is at that level. And so wherever that takes me right now is kind of where I will end up. For a while, that was with software architects, providing, you know, grounding what they do in real world customers making stuff. So it's a little less theoretical. Now it's back to the user experience folks. Yeah.
Awesome. So for life and career story, I think that's pretty close to wrapped up. If we have more time, I would keep poking at it because it's super interesting to me. Kind of the next thing I wanted to dig into a little bit is you've been around, you've seen some shit. And I like kind of thinking through, I think you're, I see you as a thinker type of person. I kind of hate the term, what's the term that just slipped my mind? Thought leadership, right? That sounds very corporate-y. But I do find myself thinking a lot about, you know, where's the future going? If I was going to talk, you know, when I talk to my machine shop friends and stuff, I'm always like, what are the things you're worried about? If you were going to start a brand new shop, what would you do? So let's start with that question right there. If you've been around design, manufacturing, all that stuff, quite a bit, a lot of software. We can actually open it up to hardware and software. If you're starting a machine shop tomorrow, you manage a shop now, maybe you have a little shop in your garage and it's time to go start a shop. What would you see as critical software or even kind of hardware? Is there anything that kind of pops out to you?
Yeah. All right. I don't care which one it is, but I would start with getting yourself a decently integrated CAD/CAM software. CAD and CAM, and know how to use both. It's great to know conversational. It's great to know G-code. There's a place in industries where all that's really powerful. But if you're opening your own shop and you want to be competitive and you want to get stuff out the door, like just commit to one and spend the time to make sure you're getting your money out of it. That's kind of an obvious one. I don't say this because it's a toolpath blog post, but I would say do not be afraid of any of the automation products, toolpath being one of them that are out there today. I would be like, if someone was starting today, I would be picking one and I would be using it. Because the benefit to having automation as part of your plan from day one, is going to be an accelerator for you. So
it's a mindset. Yeah. And I don't try to turn this podcast into a toolpath thing. Right. But I got freaking excited about this stupid little adapter thing yesterday. My buddy asked me, basically it's my buddy runs a race shop and he was like, SOS, I need help. And lots of people send me those messages because they know I got a machine in my garage and I very often punt that sucker down to a friend that owns a shop. And I was like, all right, send me a sketch, and some pictures. And then I was like, all right, let me just, use it as part of what I do, especially with my neck all jacked up, is I sit on the recliner and I try to break toolpath all day and make tickets and tickets and tickets. And so I throw it through toolpath and I'm like, holy shit, I'm going to make this thing. And yeah, so that's my point is just in the last year, to your point, like pick one and learn about it. It's a different kind of mind shift of, okay, so to be honest, I was ready to make this thing from first text to ready to go make it 50 minutes.
Oh, I got one faster for you. It's way less complicated, but
let me tell you the punchline real quick. So then Carol, she's been running my machine because I can't freaking load tools and all that. She's working out, has to go to the store, all this stuff. And I was my own worst enemy because I was ready to go to the machine shop in 50 minutes. And that's back and forth with my buddy, design, all this stuff. And then I didn't actually make it till the next morning because she didn't want to go work in the shop when it was 95 degrees and all that. So I micromanaged the shit out of the toolpaths. I spent another hour just making a bunch of toolpaths that didn't need to be, I mean, they're fancier, but the part didn't turn out any different is my point. So keep, what was the story you're going to share?
Well, I'm a big fan of the Chatter guys, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. being in a rural part or more rural than a city, and having a shop and a business taking stuff on the side of my daily corporate job, I get asked to do a lot of like just simple dirty parts, having the plasma and 20 ton press brake and finger brake and having a mentor who's willing to tell me my welds are too ashy or my puddles undercutting, get my welding under control.
Who would that be?
Who would that be?
Keep going.
That I put stuff out on my plasma table more than I do anything else right now. And that's awesome. Plasma table, like many, has got a 2D control on it with a USB stick. But
I see
if someone shows up with a pencil drawing between Fusion templates, a container method, and ChatterSync on a Raspberry Pi plugged into the back of the USB port, I am down to 7 minutes. You give me the contour, and I can have G-code for that plasma in about, like, all right, if it's a really complicated contour, but like it is nearly effortless at that point.
That's to drive awesome. Plasma.
And I've got a library of material thicknesses. I know exactly what I'm doing. If you're outside of that, we may have to do some process experimentation to get the kerf right and keep the dross down and all that good stuff to get nice parts. But if you're in my standard library, boom, it's like done.
That was the magic for me the other night. Was I've made quite a few parts. I mean, there's like I made this, which is not an inconsequential, like it's not a trivial part, right? Especially if you go back 20 years of my career. But just sorting the tool, grabbing the tools that I knew I had in my machine, it was like that. I would have punted it just because I didn't want to go like deal with that. But my main point there is kind of like you were saying, like to stay in this industry a long time, not you said specifically like stay at Autodesk for a long time. You gotta be willing to learn new stuff and be good at learning new stuff. It's the same with everybody in our industry, right?
Try stuff and not be good at it right at first, right? A lot of people are afraid of not being great at it right to begin with. That's okay.
Yeah, I think tattooing a brand on your shoulder and being like taking that to my grave is a rough way to get through a career. So when we think about tools like Toolpath or even we have basically a competitor, I suggest everybody go learn those things, figure out, build those relationships you were talking about at the RC car track, right?
Hangout track, get involved. Right? It can be literal or an expression and metaphorical.
That's that when I think about if I was building a shop tomorrow, that's the stuff I think about is what are the relationships I have to build? What are the tools I'm going to have to learn? And like, what's the mind shift that I have to start being ready for? Right. I made a very good career out of micromanaging toolpaths. And that's like something that's really interesting for me to like, well, I would have just sent that thing to the machine in 50 minutes from, you know, concept to 20 minutes of back and forth about dimensions. And it would have been a very nice part.
Yeah.
Instead, while I was waiting for Carol to bring me back my beer from the store or whatever, I bet you I could do this better. So anyway, so let's move on. So that's a really good perspective. On that note, my next question was, one thing you can think about in manufacturing software right now that anybody or everybody's kind of getting wrong for how shops like actually work. Is there anything that jumps out? And pass is a fine question for
sure.
Any of these.
No, man, it's a very simple answer. It's the part of the process I hate the most right now. And nobody does a good job with it. And mm-hmm. that is the part comes in and I've got 7 shops that I can call to get a quote, to get a material. I got a shop that's got drops that I can call that may or may not have the material that they'll sell me even cheaper. Yeah. I still think sourcing material is an unsolved problem. And there's
sure.
things that I would take if I knew I could get it at a price, but the time to figure that out, like actually programming the part now takes less time than it will take me likely to feel good that I got the material at a price and margin in my process that makes sense. And so
that's a good one. That's a good one.
I can go automate that fourth axis and get a part that looks just, you'll probably find something wrong with it, but I'd be pretty.
I celebrate everybody's stuff.
Time it takes me to sit down and like, all right, I can get that price out on Airport Way by the airport from this vendor for this. Oh God, it's just,
I've got a very good inside person at my material supplier. Tools have been kind of that way for me for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. Is I'm just annoyed. I'm just really annoyed. And I'm not trying to plug Toolpath again, but like that's I get to kind of help steer Toolpath a direction. So I'm going to try to scratch my annoyances. So we've got a really neat tool recommendation engine that I'm pretty excited about. So that's cool.
I want somebody to solve for me.
Yeah,
you know,
I love it.
And I want somebody to tell me like, hey, the last 3 jobs, if you had just bought this, you know, maybe you should buy a length. And you know, I've got a bandsaw; I can take care of making my own slugs if I need, or somebody, you know, some software to look at what I've done over the history and said, hey, you should just be keeping this on the shelves and buying it at a discount in volume. It takes some real effort to kind of go back and look and analyze, predict, watch prices, watch vendors, look for specials. Like there's so many angles to this problem. And
there is,
material cost is sunk cost in the parts price. It's a big deal.
For sure. And I've got 20 something years of working with a person. Okay. So we're coming up on the top of the hour. We have a few minutes left. I put out on Instagram, anybody have any questions for the Godfather, Kevin Schneider? So the first one was, So the first one was from, my buddy Morgan. See if he wants to talk about about the sketch solver and how Fusion has evolved. Talk about that while I check to see if any other interesting stuff came in.
State of the art at the time we started was you bought a sketch solver or you made your own. Mm-hmm. Most of the ones that you would buy started as 2D sketch solvers. And 3D sketching was added on after.
Kevin, nobody knows what a sketch solver is except you and Morgan. So can you give that real quick?
It's the mathematical algorithms that take the lines, constraints, and dimensions and solves the geometry as you make changes and drag it and add geometry and ensures that those various different dimensions and constraints. So if you draw your 2D shape and it's a rectangle and it's X number of units wide and X number of units tall, it's ensuring all of that solves. And if you've ever routed systems, you know you need to do that in 3D. And again, over time, those things were built separately. Fusion made a choice to not distinguish between a 2D sketch and a 3D sketch. Any 2D sketch can become 3D, and any 3D sketch can become 2D. And you can go back and forth. That required a brand new solver be written to do that. And anytime you write something new, it's not going to be as feature complete as something that's 20 years old. And Fusion's journey has.
That's a nice way to say that. I'm going to use that for Toolpath.
Yeah. maturity comes with time. Sometimes. You and I may prove that to be wrong.
I'm still improving.
For Morgan, the simple answer was we didn't want to keep the barriers between 2D sketching and 3D sketching that existed, and that required a new solver be written.
Got it. I'm a pretty crappy 3D sketcher. And it goes directly to, I haven't really had to be good at it. So I get through it, but, I've seen, you know, Bryce or a few other people, you know, dance around in it pretty nice. Talking about sketches, is there a way to change the shade of these lines, like the blue,
change environments? Each environment has a different set of colors.
Yeah. I think my eyes are going weird. Yeah. And the contrast is messing with me. Something come with Fusion. Oh, Mike asked, is there something coming in Fusion Cam that you can share? Anything fun coming? Where would somebody go find? There's still public roadmap stuff that's shared, right?
There is. Yeah. The Fusion blog will cover a lot. Look, it's probably something that has just, I'll pick something that has just come out. I was a big part of joints. I'm sure I'm going to get, hate mail and love mail on this topic. I'm also a big, I'm also a big fan of constraints. So, it's taken
playing both sides of the fence.
it's tools in the tools box. So, it's taken Fusion some time to solve this problem, but I can definitely tell you, I've got a couple fifth axis. Shout out to fifth axis guys. Love your stuff. I'm trying to push my machine for faster material removal rates. I like dovetailing the bottom of my aluminum and just going at it fast. And that dovetail holds it nice. Yeah. Try and position your stock in a dovetail vise to without constraints is a exercise in
cursing.
So,
I think you were you were pretty fundamental in me coming up with a good system with that. We talked about being able to move joint origins and joints and stuff. It was a life changer for me. I have a good system enough to where I haven't played with constraints yet. It's something I have to do. I understood SolidWorks constraints. So I understand the concept. I need to take time to play with it. Wow. So that could be game changer for what I'll share is a conversion person that came from other tools to Fusion. It was the single biggest hurdle I'd ever had, getting into Fusion, like sketches, parametrics, all that makes sense. Man, how do I make assemblies? Yeah. Until I watched, I think Bryce did a Fusion for SolidWorks user video or something like that. And then it was like light bulb. I actually, maybe I don't have the popular opinion. I have since become a joint lover.
Yeah. It's 90% of the time it's the better answer for me.
Yeah.
I also know it really well, partly because, you know, I've spent a lot of time with it.
Kevin, I've kept you a few minutes longer than I wanted to wrap up at the top of the hour. Okay. So thank you for your time. Yeah. See if I have any fun questions. Oh, okay. Last question I'll wrap up with, and then we'll see if you want to grab real quick any of the star stuff I talked about. One piece of advice or wisdom you would leave for, let's keep it to machinist people, right? You know the machinist community pretty well. I always try to encourage people to be like very hungry learners and stuff like that. What is there anything that jumps out to you that you would like to kind of encourage the community to give them some advice or whatever?
I guess the thing that I find the advice I would give is be less tribal. I find the CAM community gets very tribal to the point that it gets in the way of meaningful discussion. And this is not everybody, but as a general, it gets pretty, you know, us and them and vendor A and B. And so I just don't see that all that helpful for the industry as a whole. And so if I was to say anything, I would just like, don't get overly invested. No need to be so tribal about little things.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. I love it. If you had a few extra minutes, do you want to, we talked about learn to listen. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about that pretty good. I think you're a pretty good example of, you know, kind of your career, you know, that being a big part of your career. I can say that it's been a big part of my career. Mistakes was the big one. Mm-hmm. I beat myself up so bad, Kevin, with making mistakes. I broke my neck. It wasn't, you know, this was kind of ran into someone around a blind corner on my dirt bike. He was going on the wrong side of the trail, but I've like gone over that 1,000 times. Like, what could I have done differently? Mm-hmm. I don't remember anything. So I just kind of move on, but I broke a $200 tool the other night, and I do not make a habit of breaking tools. And it was just a mistake of rushing, right? Mm-hmm. I think the machinist community is either pretty accepting of mistakes, or I think a lot of people are just really heavy on themselves for making mistakes. It's kind of done me well in my career, but because I'm too stupid to be scared, but yeah, talk a little bit about your bigger thinking on mistakes. Yeah.
Well, as a habit I had to learn, it's why I like pen and paper, pencil and paper as a fast way to make notes.
Yeah.
What I would just say is a good practice to get into is when a mistake happens, spend a little bit of time and write down what would you change to not make that mistake again, you know, making the same mistake twice. Like, so what do you do to not make that same mistake again? And you might, you know, look at kind of Six Sigma and Lean and some of the practices that come out of those systems. Their continuous improvement is a big area of discussion. Something you can kind of take away from that is you should really like never make the same mistake twice. So figure out like, what happened and it, make a change so that it doesn't happen again. You can't always, you know, can't always prevent the guy from being on the other side of the track. But where this becomes really practical and real is I think we've all been in a moment. We got a problem. We're working on it really fast and hard. We solve the problem or something went wrong and we fix it and you feel really good. It's like, yeah, I solved that problem. That was great. And then 6 weeks later, you have the same problem again. And you're like, oh, crap. I don't remember what I did to fix it.
Yeah.
And that's where I, you know, it's not just like the mistake. It's kind of this approach of giving yourself those breadcrumbs to remember what you did. And as I've done that, it's really affected my productivity and my mental health, you know, because I don't feel so bad about myself not remembering what I did. And I solve it again. And like that lesson I learned is not just valuable once. Now it's been valuable twice. And
do you go back and review this stuff, or the process of thinking about it and writing it down kind of, you know,
I think it's that it helps.
Yeah, me too.
You know, occasionally there's some gold and, you know, it shows up on the, you know, as a post-it note up on the whiteboard back there, or there's a cheap magnet whiteboard on every one of my machines where like that little nugget of wisdom that's squirreled away.
Yeah.
But in general, I think the writing it down for me helps encode it.
That's an interesting, topic for me because, you know, I have a long history in racing. I've always been very meticulous about, you know, having like a post-mortem kind of review of the race and just that process of like, do this better, don't do that again, do this better, work on this. Yeah, that locks it in for me. And maybe I don't do that enough with other things in my life. Interestingly enough, like I'm very forgiving of people's first mistake. Not really with my own. It's probably something I should see a shrink about. Awesome. Well, Kevin, you're one of my favorite people. I appreciate your time. I know you keep a busy schedule. You're an important person in the industry. I consider myself lucky to have you a personal friend. Share your story. Keep doing awesome stuff. You are a very important person to the history of what we do. I'll leave it open to you if you want to end with anything.
Look, I, as you know, and I've said many times, I'm glad you're still with us. Super appreciate you as a friend.
Me too.
Say hi to the whole team there. I know a bunch of them. Missed many of them. So
yeah.
Take care.
Cool, man. Thanks for your time. Cheers.